Hello and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep minute by minute into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I am Zach.
And we are back. It's just the two of us this week.
Oh, two is the loneliest number, according to that song.
We are back talking more about Dune Part 2.
We're here, man.
We are.
We have... I'm coming off the high of last week.
Yeah.
This might feel like a low energy week.
This might feel like a low energy week. It's going to be much shorter episodes this week, though every time we say that, I feel like we have a long episode somewhere in the middle of that with us just shooting the shit. So
I'm certain that we can fill out the gaps in this. This is, of course, a week full of fighting.
It's a choreography week.
It is, yes. We get to see Roger Wan in his glory this week.
Yeah.
And all of our Lanville standing that we have done over the past year.
Get it all out because it's over this week.
This is it. This is where it is.
Yeah.
It's where it ends. But before that, man, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It's starting to get gross outside. So I'm very thankful that we have a very nice, cool place to record this.
That's very true. Early listeners of the Dune Minute will remember that we used to record in my living room instead of your living room.
Yes.
And my air conditioning system is not nearly as quiet as yours.
Yours is very loud. The HVAC main blower is like right there in your living room.
That's true. And according to all available HVAC scientists that I've had come out, there is no way to fix it.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, which is wonderful for me.
Unless you're spending like a lot of money to just replace the whole fucking thing, probably.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a condo complex, so it's like space is super limited there. I have lightly floated the idea of maybe moving that whole unit up into the attic because I live on the top floor. I have attic access.
Sure.
And that would cut down on the noise drastically.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know if my HOA will allow me to do that.
Those damn HOAs.
I know, man. Listen, they're good sometimes, like when they're doing things like maintaining the pool and the gym and the landscaping and everything, but that's about where it ends.
Well, we're not here to talk about HOAs any more than we have to.
We are
here to talk about minute 75 through 76 of Dune Part 2. And we left off with Deez last week. Beginning with a shrug.
Yes.
And we're continuing with the rest of this very wide, very large Vladimir Jabba the Hutt style kind of...
Very cheeky. He's a very cheeky shrug.
Yeah.
He's got some sass, you know?
Well, I mean, he is pretty fucking gay, so...
Canonically, yes.
Yeah.
You know, we see the Baron in a lot of... very serious moments.
Yeah.
When he's telling Raban to squeeze or feel the pressure on his neck or whatever that line is, when he's killing other dukes and things like that. This is one of the few points of levity, I think, that we've seen out of the Baron.
I think this is about as much excitement and fun that the Baron likes to show on his face.
Right. We'll get a lot
of... Which is mostly just a shit-eating smirk.
So, we get this cheeky grin, we get this arm motion, and Fade turns around.
Well, don't forget the hookah in hand as well.
That's true. He has his hookah in hand. I have that later in my notes.
He's been hanging out in a lot of Atlanta clubs.
It seems like every restaurant, or I'll say a lot of restaurants in Atlanta, past like 9 p.m., become just hookah clubs.
Yeah.
Hookah bars and clubs.
Yeah.
The one that confuses the hell out of me, and I've never been here, so I can't cast judgment on the actual restaurant, but the one that confuses the hell out of me is this place called the Juicy Crab.
I've heard of it. Never been there.
It is right down the street from my house, not to dox myself. There's a number of them in the city, so I feel okay with saying that.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's your house, so... Yeah.
Also live in a densely populated area.
You so do.
We'll be fine. But whenever I go out at night, man, I'm like, I would love some seafood. I enjoy a good crab leg, but I don't know if I want to go there. I don't, is it going to be a club or is it going to be a restaurant? I'm cool with either. I just want to know what I'm getting into.
Yeah. There are two, there's like a pizza place that you drive by whenever you come here to my house to record.
Pizza place.
And it becomes a hookah lounge at night. And then there's another lounge, like sports bar thing right next to it that also becomes a different hookah lounge at night. So like,
hell yeah.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, that whole place is just a complete shit show.
Hell yeah, dude. Hey, they found a business venture. It works, I guess. I can't knock them for that.
I mean, look, you know, if Vladimir likes it, why shouldn't everyone?
Yeah. And truth be told, I do enjoy going to a hookah lounge. I just want to know what I'm getting into.
Yeah.
So he's got his hookah, and we will be seeing him hit that puff on it. I don't know what you call the
hit that shit.
The act of smoking hookah. he'll be doing that throughout the week.
Yeah.
So down in the arena, Fade turns and he starts walking back to the center of this triangle shaped arena.
Yep. The rounded triangle.
Yeah. And I almost fast forwarded through this part.
It's because it's...
Well, no, it's not because it's boring. It's because those goddamn trumpets. That... I don't know if I've ever expressed this on the show. I know I've expressed this to you personally, but...
Yeah, and I take great offense as a brass player.
Trumpet is my least favorite instrument. If you can play it well, it's wonderful. But I feel like the divide between playing it well and playing it really shitty is...
It's a very thin line.
Yes. And a shitty trumpet is the worst thing on earth to my, to my ears. To my ears.
It is a very piercing sound. I was down visiting my parents last year about this time. And I was helping them get ready for a move and everything. And we found some old home videos and stuff of middle school concerts that I had. Mm-hmm. I understand why you hate trumpets. Yeah.
Were you a shitty trumpet player, John?
I wasn't a shitty trumpet. Well, okay. So like in
you sixth, were a young trumpet
in sixth
player.
Grade, I wasn't great. By the time I got to like 11th, 12th grade, I was very good. But like sixth grade, when I'm like a year into it, oof.
No, this rough. This is not to rag on brass or wind instruments, because a shitty percussionist, which I once was,
yeah,
is equally infuriating.
Yeah. Shitty trumpet is still nowhere near as bad as shitty saxophone.
Yeah.
Or shitty clarinet.
Ugh.
Any like shitty reeded instruments are the worst ones.
Yes. As a brass player yourself and as a percussionist myself, we can also, we always gang up on the woodwinds. Solidarity in that.
I'm just thinking about like, a fourth grade recorder's ensemble just being as shitty as it possibly can be.
Jesus Christ, that is the worst.
That would like, be my actual hell, is having to listen to fucking
did you fourth have to, grade. You had to do that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, same here.
Fucking everyone playing Hot Cross Buns out of time.
Yeah.
Super fucking loud.
And that's the recorder's one of those instruments where it actually matters about your intonation.
Yeah. Oh, so and even if, and even I don't
if
know
you
about
have your fingers over the holes correctly, if you're not blowing hard enough, it's going to sound like the pitch is going to like warble.
Yep. I don't know if about you, but I remember our fourth and fifth grade music class. We used to do our concerts in the gym. So the echoiest room in all of the fucking school.
Great acoustics in the gym.
Yeah. Plus recorders. Like, holy shit, dude.
Yeah, well, that is exactly what these trumpets or horns or whatever they are. That's exactly what they sound like to me. They were grating on my ears, and I almost just fast-forwarded through this part. But we
this
have,
was not a part of the minute that you went back and watched.
No, absolutely not.
All right.
But it's fanfare.
Sure.
It is fanfare as Fade is walking out to the middle of the arena. And we get to see some interesting characters in the background.
Some sneaky little guys.
Yeah. They're some hammerhead hatted folks, I guess. The official name, I found two names for these folks in the background here. I guess the more official name is the Picadors.
That is what Art and Soul calls them.
Yep. So the Picadors, the book, and the Dune Works calls them the Barb Men.
Okay.
I mean, it works. It's a very functional title.
Sure. Picador's got a little more pizzazz to it.
European flair.
A little more spice.
Yeah, there you
not
go.
Not just salt.
So, I want to talk just a smidge.
A dash of cayenne, if you will.
I want to talk just a smidge about the Picadors. As soon as I can find.
Well, while you're looking for that, I have some notes from Art and Soul about the Picadors.
Okay.
Not a lot. Most of this section is just all about some of the choreography that we'll talk about later on in the week and, you know, pictures of the Picadors and their hooks and everything. But mm-hmm. Art and Soul did make a note to say that, you know, the Picador helmets that they're all wearing here went through several iterations of design and everything because they wanted them to be very off-putting and very weird and, you know,
achieved.
Yeah. And, you know, make it off-putting and weird, but also very simple.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately there's no like representation of what some of the earlier designs were, but that like downward, you know, curved horn set of horns and everything off on the side to make the head like super wide, but then also have the like completely blacked out face. So you can't even see like where they're looking and everything.
Right.
There you go.
It's very, off-putting is correct. They have achieved that goal.
And once again, this is all shot on infrared cameras. So, you know, Art and Soul talks a lot about how there was just so much work that went into, you know, material design and finding a mix and match. And this applies to, you know, Fade's armor and everything as well. A mix and match of metals and leathers and plastics and everything to, like, have that completely blacked out look, but then also not be transparent. Because if you were just wearing a black t-shirt, like, you know, I'm wearing right now, and you had infrared cameras, you would actually be able to like see through that shirt, kind of.
Gross.
Not fully.
I don't want that.
Gross.
Gross.
No, but like there's parts of t-shirts or whatever that are more dense, or like, you know, how you have a shirt for a really long time and like the area around like the armpits and stuff like wears out because you're moving your arms a lot and like the fabric rubs against each other. So they needed to make sure that it was.
That's why I never move my arms when I walk. I don't know if you ever noticed that.
Yeah, you just walk with your arms perfectly like straight at your side.
I don't want to wear out my shirts.
Yeah, that's fair. they talk about how like all of the clothing had to be like especially thick to prevent any of that kind of
interesting
bleed from skin tones underneath the outfits. So
things you never think about on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, that's really cool. I'm glad they did it.
Attention to detail.
Yep.
Now, while we're talking about attention to detail, I want to talk about a lack of attention to detail.
Can I do my spiel? I
forgot that you were finding your notes while I was ranting.
So the Barb Men, or the Picadors, as they're called in the movie, they are the guards of the gladiatorial arena on Gedi Prime. And they have these long sticks with barbs at the end of it, hence the name. And they're used to keep the gladiators at bay. Now, most of the time, as we'll see here in just a second, or we've already seen, I guess, the gladiators are drugged, so the fights are rigged from the beginning.
We can't have a fair fight.
No, absolutely not. And if the gladiators start to maybe get the upper hand, or they're, you know, trying to escape or whatever, they're going to use these barbs to subdue them. And there's a little bit more to their function, which we'll get into later in the week. I don't want to give everything, but they are basically the guards to make sure that the fight is progressing as it should be.
Okay.
In the arena.
They are the heavily weighted towards the Harkonnen fighter referee that is there to make sure that things go as planned.
Right. Exactly.
Got it. While we're talking about their, you know, barbed sticks and everything, Art and Soul refers to them as Banderillas, which are the same. It's the same name as the, you know, barbed stick that bullfighters in Spain have. Side note, I think bullfighting is horrible and gross. But
agreed.
Yeah. It's torture. That's what it is.
Let's, yeah, it's not a good call practice. It what it is.
You say culture, I say torture. Not you.
I was like, when did I ever say that? No, I agree with you.
No, but there are...
Yeah, well, that's an age-old fight that we're not going to get into on this show.
No.
But I am firmly in your camp on it is a reprehensible practice.
Yeah. It's gross. Don't do it. Like, fucking... Yeah. I also have opinions on rodeo as well. It's not as egregious, but it still is like...
It's still not great.
It's not good. You're putting these bulls under a lot of stress.
Yes. My only counter to that, and I'm not advocating for it because I feel the same way you do.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fucking fun to go to one.
They're fun to go to. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. It is not a good practice. I went to one big one in Montgomery, Alabama, when I was a child. Mm-hmm. I remember having a blast.
Sure.
But I don't think the ASPCA would have enjoyed the practices that go on there.
No. My mom is a like 35 plus year, you know, in veterinary medicine, you know, person with her career. And whenever we would see bullfights on TV, she'd always root for the bull to just like kick the shit out of people. It was always a good time.
What are your thoughts on the running of the bulls? I think that's a pretty fair playing field, honestly.
Yeah, but the problem is that they still like fucking torture the bulls at the end of it and everything. Okay. So,
well,
yeah.
Can't win.
No.
So we should stop.
Yeah. Just, you know, don't be a dick to animals.
Yeah.
It's not so hard.
It's not hard. So, was that all that you had to say?
That was all that I had to say about the picadors and everything. Okay. But as I was going to say earlier, you know, there's a lot of attention to detail in the design of the, you know, clothing and everything for the infrared lighting. There's not a lot of attention to detail in the crowd. And I know we touched on this last week, but it's even more egregious in this week's minutes, I feel, because you can definitely see like the sections where it's just like copy pasted, repeating like the patterns and everything. And the crowd looks very odd and off putting because like you have to generate 10,000 people in this audience, and some of them are way closer to the camera than you probably want them to be.
I'm gonna give a a hint of beef.
Okay.
I think it's in tomorrow's episode, and I want to spend some time talking about the crowd and just some possibly bad CG, but anyways, or bad green screen.
Oh, okay. Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
We'll get there. So in order to get there, we have to explain this minute, though. So Fade is walking out.
Yes.
He is holding both of his blades, one black and one white.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, this is not a storyline that we get in the movie, unfortunately, but historically, the white blade is poisoned.
We did talk about this with these last week as well.
But it was left out of the movie for whatever reason.
Probably didn't really need it.
No.
Yeah.
It plays a part in the books a lot. I guess in the scene in the books, it plays a pretty big part. But yeah, for the story they're telling here, it wasn't needed.
Yeah. We do have some more translated Harkonnen from the announcer.
Yeah.
In celebration of our Na Baron Fade Rautha, we present a special treat. And then Fade is staring intently at these revolving doors in front of him.
Very vaginal doors.
Yeah. So we talked about this a little bit in our when we were talking about part one and everything, but like Art and Soul doesn't really like reference it directly, but you can tell that there's a lot of H.R. Geiger influence in a lot of the Harkonnen architecture and design and everything.
Sure.
And as you know or may not know, H.R. Geiger puts a lot of dicks and vaginas in all of his art. It's just dick everywhere. So
yeah, it's it's not just the way that the doors open, because it's kind of like a two-bladed aperture opening that happens.
Yeah, you have one turning clockwise and one counterclockwise. Yeah. So it makes like a weird, it's almost like a walnut shaped mm-hmm. door when it's open, and
like an almond shape.
That one.
Yeah, an almond. Yeah.
Not a walnut.
No, walnuts. Yeah. But even like I'm going to call it the door frame, like the architecture around the door.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminded me of a Georgia O'Keeffe painting almost.
Yeah.
Which is no secret, incredibly vaginal.
Yeah.
So we don't have to harp on it. We don't have to spend any more time. I just want to say very vaginal door.
Yep. But as the door's beginning to twist open, we see for the first time in a while,
mm-hmm.
a shield being deployed on a person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because we're in the under the black sun of Gady Prime, it is not the like typical, you know, blue red that we're used to. It's just like a black like blob around him for a moment as it's activating.
We see more of the shimmer than we do of the actual shield, like the body distortion aspect. I was going to note that this is the first personal shield I think that we've seen this entire movie. We've seen them on ornithopters.
Mm-hmm. None of the Harkonnen goons had them, because shields attract worms. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So first personal shield of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So out of this door that is opening, a real beefy dude starts to stumble out.
A real beefcake, but he's not walking, you know, walking straight.
Yeah, stumbles out is maybe a better way of saying it.
And our last translation, the last three specimen of House Atreides.
Now, did you clock the translation or the Harkonnen language for House Atreides?
It sounded like Home Atreides.
Yeah. It was just Home Atreides, which I could be way off here, and don't at me, but that sounds like it would be from some kind of French-based language.
I would have assumed it would be more Germanic than French.
Okay, maybe so.
Yeah. Gonna be honest with you, didn't look at the website with all of the language deconstruction for Harkonnen and stuff. So
fair enough.
Oops.
So the camera pans kind of a wide shot around Fade, and we see two other doors of the same make opening up around him. So mm-hmm. one on each side of this rounded triangle.
Each vertex of the triangle?
Sure.
Yeah.
You wanted to be a fucking nerd about it.
I mean, I think that's right.
How dare you be a nerd on this Dune podcast, John? A vertex is the...
Yes, it's the point.
Yeah, the midpoint.
Okay. Well, no, the actual like angular point.
Okay. The endpoints. Okay. Cool. So from these vertex doors, we get to see two other people emerging, one other person stumbling.
Yep.
And one person is walking relatively normal. Now each person, as they are exiting the doors, they all cover their eyes because they are just blinded.
Just like us last week, they also get hit with the most flashbang of flashbangs.
Right.
Because who knows how long Lanville and the rest of the Atreides guys have been down in these dark, you know, dingy-ass dungeons.
It's true. It's important to note that the person we see stumbling out first, the one that gets like this, the camera shot directly on them, is the person from the goon session that we saw last week getting the needle shot into his neck.
Yeah.
So we know clearly from context clues and things that have been told to us before, this person is heavily drugged. But Lanville is not. And Lanville is one of the ones who is coming out of one of the vertex doors and holds his hand up to block the sun. And we cut then from the, I guess, from the POV of the Bene Gesserit box is what I assumed.
Well, we cut to that because we're then ending the minute on Margot's perspective through her opera glasses.
Right, right. So as the minute is ending, we see the three Atreides start to kind of close in on Fade.
And she, you know, kind of begins to lower her glasses like she's going to say something. But that's it. That's our minute.
That's all that we got. So, oh, man. Where to begin on book notes? This is one of my favorite chapters in the book.
Okay. Care to elaborate, or are you just going to end with that?
All right, I'll say a little bit more.
Twist my arm, why don't you?
So this chapter is really where we get to see a lot of Count Hasimir Frenring. So this chapter is basically two parts. It is the first part is the Fenrings interaction with the Baron and with a little bit of Fade. And the second part is the actual fight. Now, the first part is awesome. The second part's good too, but the first part's great.
Yeah.
Because we get to see just how cunning and smart the Fenrings are as a couple. And particularly how awesome Hasimir Fenring is.
Truly the most power couple of couples the Dune universe.
Yes, absolutely.
I would argue in most of sci-fi.
They're up there for sure.
Yeah.
I want to say that they did great casting on Margot Fenring in the movie.
And potentially fantastic casting on Hasimir, but we'll never know.
That's true. We won't. I'd like to just read a small passage from the book describing Lady Fenring here, Margot Fenring.
Okay.
Fade Rautha dipped his head with the required courtesy. He stared at Lady Fenring. She was golden-haired and willowy, her perfection of figure clothed in a flowering gown of ikru. Don't know what that means. Simple fitness, a form without ornament. Gray-green eyes stared back at him. She had that Bene Gesserit serene repose about her that the young man found subtly disturbing.
Yeah, Lea Seydoux is like the perfect casting for that description. Holy shit.
Yep. I mean, golden-haired, willowy. Yes, that is her to begin with. But
the gray-green eyes.
Just the aura that she gives off is perfect.
Yeah.
So wonderful, wonderful casting there. One of the things that, and I'm so sad we don't get this. I mean, it's probably not going to be in the third movie if they didn't introduce it here, but maybe we'll see. Is the way that Count Fenring talks to his wife.
The words between words stuff?
The words between words. Yeah. So if you're reading it on the page, I mean, they tell you pretty early on that they're speaking a secret language to each other, but Fenring gives off this, like, he's very feeble, kind of stuttering guy. And it makes him seem much more unassuming than he actually is.
Yeah. I think when we were first, like, before we were even, like, talking about the podcast and everything, or, you know, even recording the podcast, like, we would just be at dinner talking about Dune because, guess what, we're a bunch of fucking nerds and stuff. And I think we kind of both came to the realization that, like, a good allegory in another, you know, character that we've seen was the Grand Maester in A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
Where, like, he acts super feeble and slow and dumb and everything, but then, like, whenever you see him, like, kind of go off into his own, he, like, pauses for a moment and, like, stands up straight and, like, stretches his back out and, like, does, like, squats and stuff, and he's, like, up and doing his thing.
Well, and that's exactly what happens in the first part of this book.
Yeah.
So Count Finnering and Lady Finnering are speaking to Fade. They meet Fade for the first time in person. And, you know, they have some conversation between them. I guess a couple of conversations between them. Because yeah. One's outward, one's in code. And then Fade goes off. The Count dismisses his wife, you know, asks her to leave him alone for a little bit. So he's just talking with Vladimir. And as soon as they're alone under this cone of silence, the stuttering stops. And he's, like, super assertive, super sure of himself. Just badass guy.
Well, I mean, I don't think Shaddam would have been best friends with someone who was, you know, incompetent or just a complete fool.
Right. The Baron goes...
Childhood friends at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Baron goes as far as describing Hasimir Finnering as this. He says, "Mark him well, Fade. A killer with the manners of a rabbit. This is the most dangerous kind."
So, it's the perfect line for describing Fenring. So, yeah.
So super bummed we don't get to see him, but I just wanted to take a moment to talk about Lady Fenring, who we do get to see, and we will see more in the coming weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Just perfect casting, I think. Lea Seydoux is perfect for this role. So I'll get to the fight as we get to it in the latter part of this chapter, but that's all that I had for today.
Alrighty. Well, I don't have anything else, so I think now's a good time to wrap it. You can find the Dune Minute online in a couple different places. On Blue Sky, we are at duneminute.com, and you can email duneminute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us that way. We will be back with another episode tomorrow. We'll see you then.
See ya.